Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
Welcome back to another episode of... And welcome back to another episode of Mostly Lit. How are you guys doing today?
Doing really good. Doing really good.
Yeah.
How's everyone?
Yes, fantastic. I'm great. It's been a decent week actually for once. Yeah, it's been decent. Haven't done much, but I felt content. Haven't woken up too groggy, too disorientated. So.
Do you use the sleep app? It's really good.
I used to use that sleep app. I used to play like.
Horrible tune.
Like waves.
You know what
yeah. You can change it.
But now what I do actually to get to sleep, I watch videos on YouTube of this thing called, I think it's called AMSR or something, where people just make weird sounds. And for it's like, it makes me feel really relaxed. And it's really strange.
AMSR.
AMSR. It's really, really
AMSR.
Weird. So there's this book. Have you read?
There's a book.
Sorry, I'm just, no, this guy, he's an artist. Wait, how can I forget his name? He was a crazy artist. He got blonde hair. He kind of like he commercialized art.
And Andy Warhol.
Yeah,
ASMR.
No. Yeah. No, basically in his book.
Oh, guys, who was that? Because we haven't actually introduced. Okay, guys.
Strange.
Who is that strange
voice?
Who's
that girl standing there?
Okay, so. Can our strange, mysterious voice introduce themselves, please?
Hello, everyone. I'm Sam Conniff.
Hi, Sam. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm a big fan of your show. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
You.
And so we're going to ask you, how has your week been?
I mean, can I finish my anecdote?
Oh, God.
So we've got a call, AMSR.
So you go to sleep with
AMSR,
the sound.
I was just going
to
say, Andy Warhol. The philosophy of Andy Warhol. There's a bit in it where he's on the phone to some woman and she literally goes through, she's got obsessive compulsive disorder with cleaning.
Yeah.
And she goes through everything that she cleans. And I remember, it's like pages and pages. I was reading it. And I was just strangely really relaxed and I was falling asleep.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is really, really weird. And then obviously when I went on YouTube and saw that there was like thousands of videos with millions of people.
It helps people with insomnia. So I used to do that a lot. Like just go.
Oh, so you know what it is?
Yeah.
I just put a podcast on.
I just put like noise.
Really?
And I fall asleep. And I put it on timer.
Yeah.
I fall asleep to it.
But I'm really glad now. I'm so tired. I just sleep. As in, I as soon as my head touches my pillow, I don't know what's happened. I just sleep.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's healthy.
I think it's not.
Sounding weird. I went to sleep listening to you lot last night.
Oh.
Really?
So we're fresh in your mind.
Episodes. Yeah. I don't know what happened at the end because I fell asleep.
Wow. Look at us guys putting people to bed.
Right.
Amazing.
So we have Sam here on the show with us.
You just said
week.
Sam. Oh, hi, I'm Sam Conniff. Like,
yeah. Like we're supposed to.
Like, you're just a.
Like, yeah,
guy.
I'm just here.
Just out here. Like.
What are you? Who are you, Sam? Who are you?
Who are you, and what are you doing here? Who let you in? I had a great week, actually.
Yeah,
a great week. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's been a really, really good week. I have a book coming out, which I'm very grateful for you reading and inviting me on to talk about. And we're a week away from publication.
Mm-hmm.
As I got home from last night's dinner, so it's been a week of promo and interviews and trying to do my very best to raise this rebel flag as far up as I can.
Yeah.
And I came back last night to an email saying that we got the bestseller thing on Amazon.
Oh, amazing. Wow.
On pre-sales, which is...
Wow, that is, yeah.
Yeah, it's not bad. Amazing.
Big news.
Second edition has gone to print because the orders are looking good.
Good.
So there's all sorts of interesting things. But as we get into the story, there's one or two things that aren't news yet that I've been saving to share with you.
Oh,
fantastic.
Exclusive.
So Sam Conniff is the author of Be More Pirate and...
We'll get into that a bit later.
Yeah, we'll get into that a bit later.
We should do the rounds because we've missed the rounds and I don't want to miss the rounds.
Okay, the rounds.
Oh, the rounds. So, what are you reading?
What am I reading this week? I'm reading Indigo Donut by Patrice Lawrence.
Ooh.
And that book, I'm halfway through it. Really good book. It chronicles the life of a young lady. I forgot what her name is actually. Indigo. She's been in foster care, and it's talking about her life with and at school and just generally growing up and her relationship with a young mixed race kid called Bailey, who has a huge ginger afro. And it's a really interesting and complex story between the two, because it's an interesting perspective on looking back on what it's like being 15, 16, and then, you know, if you're in school and you've got a new person in your class, and you know, everybody kind of knows, oh, they're in social care and this, that, and the other, but nobody wants to ask the questions. So they're kind of breaking down a lot of these taboos about it. There's a loads of questions about mixed race identity in there. It's a really good book and it's a really interesting story. A bit like some of the characters frustrate me, but I think the story is growing into something that I would really recommend. Like, anybody who's interested in any YA to go and read. And obviously, I trust it because it's Patrice Lawrence. Yeah. So, I mean, I trust
it. I'm so happy you're, like, reading fiction.
Yeah.
I'm very happy.
So, context. So, Ray and Derek have been trying to get me to read more real books.
No, non-fiction are real books. Just
no, you said...
I'm reading non-fiction now.
Don't look at me. I've never said anything like
that. No,
I've just said I don't like to read it, but now I'm kind
of... just because I've written a non-fiction. Fiction's coming next,
don't worry. Hey,
they told me that I need to read more fiction books, so...
And I need to read more non-fiction.
But I have been reading more fiction and YA books in particular.
It's a very different kind of writing, so it's... I've got to have a bit of both.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, definitely, I think so.
But yeah, but Indigo Donut's really good, and I'm really into it so far.
Okay.
So yeah, that's what I've been reading this week.
Nice. Cool. How about you, Derek? What have you been reading?
I've been listening to one book and reading one. So after I finished with Be More Pirate...
I was going to say, I thought you were reading Be More Pirate.
Yeah, yeah.
We are, but...
But after I finished reading it, I went back and I read Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Because
a lot of the things you talk about in there, I thought, okay, let me go back to that and kind of get more invigorated after, do you know what I mean?
I love interesting,
and I was listening to...
Is that one of the few things that you've told me to read that I've loved?
It's amazing. Of course, I knew you love him because you're very individualistic and...
Wow, is that even a compliment?
It is a compliment in a way.
It's very Western.
And you're very overconfident, which Emerson definitely was. Not a bad thing. And also listening to this, it's called This Audiobook Will Put You to Sleep.
There's
a book coming out called This Book Will Put You to Sleep. And it's just like really boring writing, and apparently it's like scientifically proven to put you to sleep. So I was listening to, and it's just the beginning bit is a guy like, one sheep, two sheep.
Oh, I count sheep.
Three.
Oh, I think I've seen that book.
Four sheep.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to start talking about...
So you didn't fall asleep after the sheep count?
No, I got up to where he starts reading an extract from Samuel Pepys's diary, which is very insulting, obviously, to Samuel Pepys, because... Before you just sleep, but loads of different extracts from different books, and it starts telling you about rocks and geology, and it says, "Would you like to know about?" Not would you like. It starts telling you about mathematics, just really things that like boring things, but it's really good. It's really interesting. It's
interesting, but it's boring.
It is. It's just.
Is it stuff that you have no general use for in life?
Hey. I don't think the point is to educate you. The point is to put you to sleep.
Okay. So how could it be interesting then? I just feel like...
When I say interesting, I mean the concept of the book is interesting.
The concept of the book's interesting. Yeah. The content isn't.
I think that's a mark of a really good writer and research, though. If you can take seemingly, you know, boring subjects and get into the depth and find the interesting story in anything. I saw an amazing talk a while ago, an entire hour on cutlery. And the psychology of cutlery, and how some restaurants can charge more because they have better cutlery. And each level, we got more and more amazed, and everyone was up in arms at the end of it. So there's something great about going deep on rocks.
Mm. Yeah, being able to talk about it, interesting. Yeah.
But actually, that's actually.
But yeah, it's not interesting in the book. It's, yeah. It puts you to sleep. But yeah, that's what I've been reading and listening to.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Right.
I have had a pretty bad reading week, actually. Okay, well, I started off trying to get into Catch 22 by Joseph Heller.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is it. Like,
I've heard two people, bad reviews, though.
So two people came up to me and they were like, this book is amazing. And yeah. I was like, okay, I like reading people's favourite books. I really think it gives you an insight into who they are. Mm. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to read it. And I got through like the first two pages and then I put it down and then I just forgot.
Is it confusing? Someone said this is confusing. Jump back and forth in time?
I haven't gotten that far.
It's quite non-linear.
Yeah.
Right. He's quite esoteric in his level of he's off the chart.
Yeah.
How little he cares. but
yeah.
It's got some magic in there. It's worth perseverance. It's not like the Samuel Pepys, I get you, right? I read a lot of 18th century and 17th century from my research. And by God, it's hard. Like, they're just, thou shalt forth. You will not to, and you're like, get to the point, man.
Yeah.
I love that shit. It's dense stuff. It's
dense with Joseph Heller.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and possibly this coming week read it. I picked up The Outsider by Albert Camus. And I'm really enjoying it.
I hope I inspired you to read that with all of my absurdist talk and nihilism.
I think, do you know what it is? I was feeling a bit low on like Wednesday. And I was like, oh, let me read something grim.
So you picked up. So you want to be even deeper in your misery.
But that's what I do.
You guys.
Yeah, that's what I do. Whenever there's like a problem, I want to go deeper in it.
You guys
are
masochists. It's all right.
When I feel depressed, I pick up Nietzsche.
Right?
Yeah.
Same.
I play soccer.
Civilization and its Discontent is my go-to, like, let me find out about the world. It's not that terrible.
That's not Nietzsche. That's Freud, isn't it?
Oh shit, that's Freud. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
But I pick up Civilization and its Discontent. With Nietzsche, I pick up Thus Spoke Zarathustra.
I could not get through that book.
Really?
I could not.
I picked that up because of Be More Pirate, actually. Because there was a part where you talked about rebellion, but we'll talk about that later. And Nietzsche's very rebellious.
Yeah.
Cool. Can I ask you a question?
What?
Okay. Sure.
I'll ask you what you're reading.
I'd love to tell you what I'm reading, but the amount you have to read, right? And I also know, you know, because you're persons of renown, so I know that you all have busy lives too. how do you get through so many books? But also, what do you think of something like Blinkist?
So...
Wait, what's Blinkist?
I was going to be like, Google!
Because the literary industry, which you kind of represent...
Really? I don't put us
there. Seems to quite dislike, or maybe fear, or resent Blinkist. But I'd love to know your
point. I just deleted it off my phone, mainly because I had to pay.
Okay, one more time. What's Blinkist?
But,
Sam, it lets you read key lessons from the book, 2,000 non-fiction books in 15 of you. I mean, that's a cheat.
Every book into 7 minutes that you can either read or listen to.
Fiction and non-fiction.
Yeah.
Fiction and non-fiction.
So it condenses them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
7 minutes. Now, is that a crime on books, or does that allow you to get to the core stuff really quickly? If it's dense and hard material, does that allow you to understand the essence of Nietzsche, or is that, you know, undermining publishing and the joy of reading?
I think trying to avoid the added arrogance of the writer and the ultimate flair around everything, because sometimes we get caught up in the flair and not the point.
Yeah.
When it's nonfiction, I like to go for the point. Yeah. So I like to just find the points of it and then take those and kind of absorb it. When it comes to fiction, I'm a bit more concerned with the story. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather them not slice away the story, but I pick up the themes as I go.
For me, coming into writing a bit of nonfiction, there are those books, right? And it was my absolute determination not to write one of those books that kind of says what it is on the cover, tells you that story in the first chapter, but the fourth chapter, like, if you tell me the same fucking thing again, story around it, I'm getting at, like, you know, Seth Godin kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's not an absolute genius, but stringing a blog post into an entire book. So those ones go down very, very well on
Blinkist.
I think I agree with Alex to a certain extent that there is something about fiction that if it's a whole body of work, I personally think it's like going on, what are those things that help you with, like, your GCSEs?
Spark notes,
and bite size.
Exactly.
It's like going on those to, but then it's like, what are you reading for?
If you are reading because you want to talk to your friends, you know, add this bit of information into a conversation. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, Nietzsche said this. And like, oh, have you read that book? Then I get why you would do that.
But if you want to actually find out about something, if you actually just want to sit down and read a book, I think it's pointless.
I don't think that's the point of Blinkist, to be able to show off to your friends.
Well, I can see how
that it can be used like that.
But if
it's nonfiction and you want to find out something very quickly, then cool, use it. But
it if you does want to make take sense your time, if you want to be introduced to the book, so you're like, all right, I want to read this book. Let me see the main points on Blinkist, and then I'll probably read the rest.
Yeah,
I don't know. It depends. Everybody has different reading styles.
So. I'll stop interrupting. So they have millions of subscribers, and they have hundreds of thousands of paying subscribers. I love it as a service, right? I get through 3 books on my walk to work, on topics I want to know about of the day. Mm. Like, that's how I went through all Varnakis's books, because I find his writing style annoys me, but I really think he's intelligent, so I want to get to it. So when I first sat down at Penguin Random House talking about marketing and plans, and I'm really keen to work with pirates, I said, what about Blinkist? And the response from the guys at Penguin Random House was, they are the enemy. They're coming to a threat.
Yeah, so to the publishing industry.
Do you think they're a threat?
I mean, audiobooks were once a threat.
What was a threat?
Blinkist.
Condensing all that in, like, so people would now then go to that service rather than buy a book.
No, I'm saying, did you say audiobooks were a threat?
Yeah, they were. In terms of actual, when it first was coming out, there were so many articles written on how audiobooks will now,
ruin the way people read.
The marketing strategy of
e-books.
Books.
E-books would ruin print.
Some in the publishing industry that think we've seen off e-books.
Yeah.
But now there's this resurgence of press, like, of actual print novels, and it's... I think it's a threat
in anything. I mean, whenever anything's new, it's always a quote unquote threat to things. I mean, like, people are going back to vinyl, people are going back to cassettes, there's and all these different things.
There's something in the generation.
Is it actually the story, or is it like somebody summarising?
So that's how they're getting around the legal technicality, right? So the book's out, they can then buy it. It's a different enough. So it's effectively like a review of the book.
Yeah.
They just sidestep the copyright issue. Keep it. Each blink is only 300 and something words, and it's an excellent and acute dissection of the text. I mean, you can really get through big materials. I just did Post-Capitalism by Paul Mason on it.
I would totally read it for non-fiction, especially when I wanted to find out something, but then it's
just another way of reading.
I think it is a threat in terms of just entries to, like,
another way of reading.
Barriers of entry. It's opening that whole sphere of people coming in, but at the same time, publishing houses are still alive and popping, so
I don't know if I would see it as a threat, though. But I mean,
the competition.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm trying
because
to
you would choose one.
I'm
or
thinking
the other.
About it in like the pirate sense now. I don't want to get into the book, but I'm thinking, is it something that publishers could then take advantage of and use? Sorry, okay, let's move on anyway. Sorry, God.
Sam, what are you reading?
I was about to go on a rant, sorry.
Yeah, then, not yet.
I'm listening to Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race.
Yay!
Which I read a long while ago, but I read because I thought I should read it because it was new and it was the thing, and I obviously didn't pay attention. And my circumstances, as I've left Liberty, which is a business I've founded and run, which works a lot with young black Londoners, young people from all over the country, actually. And the board, there's a change going on, so I wanted to revisit the text because I thought there was some useful stuff in there. But unfortunately, the author's read the book and she reads it in a really... you do audiobook, don't you?
Yeah.
Have you listened to it?
I haven't, not that one, no.
It's for such an interesting and important text, it's really seems really badly produced, like, no offence to them. But, the volume comes in and out, she doesn't sound... there's no passion, it's really flatly read.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
It's a real disappointment.
I think that comes down to the way a lot of publishing houses see audiobooks, so someone like Penguin Random House, they put a lot of production into their audiobooks.
I have to say, whenever I listen to a Penguin book, it's like really character led. Just in the story.
Yeah, but when it comes to audiobooks, Penguin Random House, like, they are definitely leading the way because they take it very seriously. I mean, it's his own imprint. Penguin Audio is his own imprint. So.
And there's a man called Roy, isn't there?
Oh, Roy's amazing. Oh, you know Roy?
Well, I did my audio bit with Roy.
Oh, yeah, of course you did. Yeah,
I'm a little bit in love.
Amazing
with Roy.
Guy. I love Roy. Yeah,
amazing.
Everybody loves Roy.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Isn't he? Right, this is the title of the episode.
Everybody loves Roy.
We love you, Roy, if we don't know you.
Okay, so.
I'm reading alongside it because I'm really interested in. I never thought I could write a book. I struggle with writing. I've always found it quite difficult. I love reading, but writing has never been my forte. And I can see that fiction would be even harder. So I'd really like to see what I can do. So I've been reading Douglas Adams, who I think is my favourite fiction author.
Oh, which what have you been reading?
I just went straight back. I'm going to start from the beginning, go through them all. So
oh, really?
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah. Are you going
to
read the Owen Colfer as well?
Yeah.
Okay,
I
okay.
interviewed him when he did it. I thought that was such an interesting, but just the writing, I think, is something else. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, what he covers and how funny it is and how sharp it is.
It's yeah.
I think it's really good to read your favourite, like, writer when you're struggling to write. I always go back to Oscar Wilde if I'm like struggling to write. Yeah,
really?
Because I love the way Oscar, like, he makes me laugh. I love the way he writes.
I used to think I love Oscar Wilde's short fiction. I like his short stories.
I love his
and I like
plays.
His essays.
I love
I
his
think
essays.
Dorian Gray is very.
I don't go back. I've never reread.
It's grating after a while. His style in that book, it makes me very. It's very sickly, if that makes sense. The way Dorian Gray's written.
Silent hand gestures to me.
He's always making silent hand gestures.
Behind the scenes, the orchestra is really beautiful.
And then it's just like.
These two ramble. And then Alex is no, and Alex lovely, just graceful like, movements trying to bring everybody back into
director. Anyways.
Sorry.
Who's lit this week, right?
Who's lit this week? Okay. Well, who's lit this week is the amazing. the new young poet laureate of, is it London?
Yeah, for London.
Yeah. And it was up on Spread the Word. Her name is Mumtaza. And she, does it normally like run for a year, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So it used to be Kayla Femi.
Yeah, it was Kayla Femi. And they actually like, they've... like written like this youth manifesto thing, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And like the other young people have like co-created a youth manifesto, which will inform Mumtaza's work as a young poet laureate. Mm-hmm. She's been like always been in very engaging with like young people from across London. And I just love it when, you know, fellow East African, I was like, yes, thank you. So go girl, we're really happy for you. And we hope you do amazing things to inspire young people of London.
The youth,
yeah. Yeah, specifically young black women. And I love the fact that it's gone from Caleb to another like amazing young black person. So yeah,
there's that.
You lit girl. Oh, we should have like the horns, like the lit horns.
What, the Bashment horns?
Yeah.
Mad.
Jeez.
Yeah, but
you don't need to. That's actually a really good
impression. Derek,
I'm glad you brought that section back. That's good.
Yay!
Yeah,
it's Alex is doing.
I have no gem today.
No gem? That's nope. Fine.
Sorry.
So we're here. Okay, with Sam Conniff.
What's the gem? What are we missing?
Like, so basically, Derek has a gem each week. Usually,
I thought that needs to be rediscovered.
That he feels that deserves discussion.
Rediscovery. Yeah. Yeah.
But you've been slacking for the past 3 weeks.
You know what it is? It's difficult now to find, because I'm a lot more picky with the gems now.
Mm.
And I'm thinking I can't just be, you know. I mean, actually, I could do, yeah, Douglas Adams. I could just do Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the first one, which I think is the best one.
Okay.
The funniest one.
I don't think I'll ever read it.
I think I'll watch it.
It's
hilarious. No, don't watch the movie.
I watched parts of the movie and I thought it was trash.
I remember I was at school, I was in year five, and there's this kid in my class, so he always used to read it. He always used to read it. And I was looking at him like, why are you reading a book like that? And I had the Harry Potter book.
Find out where he is now. He's in charge of something.
Definitely.
I see him on the train to work sometimes.
You're thinking, oh, it's sci-fi, but it's funny sci-fi. It's not like, it's a space opera? It kind of is a space opera, but it's fucking, I had tears in my eyes when I was reading it. The first 10 pages, I was crying. I couldn't believe it.
How old were you when you first read it?
I was like 24.
Okay, you're a big man.
It's just time for me.
And it's really, really clever as well. And the way he writes, you're right, the way he really writes is amazing. And the fourth book, I think the writing in the fourth book is the best he's ever written, but the story is not the strongest in the fourth book. I didn't really like the whole love angle that he was taking in the fourth book, and I didn't like that it was mostly set on Earth either.
But if, you know, so some of the topics that I've heard you discuss, and particularly you two, as you argue very, some of the more intellectual themes or some of the thinkers that you explore, Douglas Adams sits in that category.
But
he seems to, or he appears to be writing comedy science fiction, but he's not. He's writing deeply thoughtful critique and investigation of life, the universe, and everything. I mean, it's a journey and a search for the of man and everything else. I mean, it's something special.
Really. How many pages is the first book?
957.
No, it's not. It's like 180. The first book's like 180.
Okay, that's not something I can read that in like a day.
It's a story in five. It's a trilogy in five parts. Is it five now?
Yes, in five parts. Yeah, God gets argued out of existence by logic in chapter 3. I mean,
are they not always trying to argue God out of existence through logic?
And we find out the meaning of the universe.
Okay,
the meaning
that
of
is
life as well.
Oh, okay, in that book,
not
in
that book
3.
In book 3, yeah.
The meaning, which don't tell me. Don't tell me what the meaning. I mean, I know what the meaning of my life is, but it's probably going to be. So you know how I love Dan Brown, right? Because I love his, like, I just love Dan Brown. And Origin, guys, like, I was raving about this book. You need to stop rolling your eyes before I come there and smack them out of your lids.
Out of your lids.
Ray. Sorry, I'm not trying to be violent.
Yeah, guys. Growth, remember.
Growth. Yes. he basically tried to argue God out of existence. There was a character in there who was trying to argue God out of existence using science, and the argument, like, I don't even remember it because that's how boring and crappy it was. And
that's Dan Brown in a nutshell.
No, that is not okay. You need to have you even read Dan Brown?
I've read The Da Vinci Code.
You need to read. Also, that's not the best Dan Brown.
Well, it's the most well known. So
yeah, well, the most well known isn't exactly the best. Okay. Anyways, so voila. I'm a bit annoyed because every time, like. His books are very, like, thrilling, so you're rushing to find the solution. And normally, like, for example, there's...
Someone described them as just someone running through doors.
Yes, you said this in a previous episode. We know.
Oh, in the films.
Yeah.
That's actually what it is.
Like, and he's all about the geography and he's always describing this. Anyways, but...
Everybody's always trying to tell God, doesn't he? And they use the same argument. This is very boring. But I will read this damn Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book for you guys, and I will get back to you.
It's nothing like Dan Brown. I can.
Is it thrilling? Because I like a nice plot.
Because most of the times you're like, oh yeah, he writes really well, which means there's no plot.
No, there's definitely a plot. I mean, there's a plot. It's funny. You know, like Sam said, there's a lot of philosophical questions that I. To be honest with you, I probably haven't picked up on a lot of them. I'm probably going to have to go back and read it.
Is it YA?
No, it's not. It's literature. It's just...
All right.
I mean, do you know what I mean?
It's literature.
Give it a go and let me know.
Yeah.
I will.
So. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Oh, my God. We haven't even gone into the main topic.
No, we haven't.
I know.
Hi, guys.
So, we're gonna talk to you about your book, Be More okay. Pirate.
Am I allowed to ask you questions?
Yeah,
later
yeah,
on,
absolutely.
But we got the questions for you first.
All right.
Yeah?
I mean,
that's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right.
You're in charge. I just got so much I want to ask you.
That's fine. What inspired you to write this book? Do you want to tell people about the book and where it came from?
Yes, please, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do we start? Well, we start 300 years ago, because 300 years ago, there were a group of frustrated young professionals in their 20s, I'm looking at you guys, with big ideas about the world around them. They lived in a society that was really pretty broken and unfair, with an establishment that was totally self-interested, in a system that didn't seem like it was going to get fixed anytime soon. Redundancy and uncertainty faced them on the horizon, and the backdrop was interconnected international conflicts that confused the fuck out of anyone that was looking to what was going on.
Mm.
I mean, the circumstances seem spookily similar.
Mm.
And the millennials of the 18th century didn't do what I worry that your generation may do, which is to accept the fact that the way things are is the way things have to be. And they said no.
Mm.
And they rejected the rules of society, and they broke them. But what distinguishes this period of piracy, why the history needs to be re-understood, is because they didn't just break the rules, they rewrote the rules.
Yeah.
And that is the distinct attribute of this set. They rewrote the rules of society, and they went and fought, yes, as we all know, but the bit we don't know so much is they went and fought for fairness and equality and equal rights and a whole new system that gave working class, underprivileged groups, people of colour, you know, all genders, equal opportunities. And the innovations that they created in the fire of going to war with the rest of the world, at war with the world, they described themselves as.
Mm-hmm.
The innovations they created in this tiny period of time, 30 years of a few thousand pirates against the empires of the world, the innovations stay with us now. And my mission, my aim is twofold. One, to put these guys where they belong. And it's a bold statement, right? I know, but I think they should be held somewhere on a spectrum between the civil rights movement and the suffragettes. That's the true space of social revolutionaries that I'd like to argue they have and should be looked up to as. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that in waving this flag exactly 300 years to the year, that perhaps on where otherwise I think there's a vacuum of imagination for leadership of your generation, and actually that this level of rebellion inspires your generation to leapfrog those in front of you and take some power.
Right.
So what I wanted to ask you is that, do you think that their motivations should play a part in how we see them? Because of course in the book you do state that these pirates were trying to change their world. They mm-hmm. weren't trying to change the world.
Yeah.
So do you think that we should take that into consideration and say, well, okay, well, they did affect all of these things around the world, but that wasn't their main intention?
Intentionality is key. I've heard you talk about this before, and I think it you know, absolutely philosophically sits behind things. And I think that's true. But I find that in... So a couple of years ago, I did a project, and it meant that I spoke to young people in nearly every country within the Commonwealth.
Oh, wow.
And what blew me away was that every single young person I spoke to, and that didn't matter whether they were rural or urban or middle class or educated or whatever it was, there's this broad sense of the world hasn't got my back. No one is coming to save me. The institutions that are supposed to be there for me, I don't believe in. Yet somehow I am completely optimistic about the future and my ability to create change. Now, the nuance there was whether change was my town, my village, my family, or the world.
Mm.
And that spectrum seems to be pretty elastic in lots of young people's mind. And I find that really, really compelling. So I don't mind when I'm talking about rebellion or this spirit of change and rule breaking. I really don't mind. I've done these workshops in the development of the book in Baltimore with young people from Detroit and in Chicago, you know, tough places. I've done them in Athens. I've done them in Bradford, Brixton. I've done them in townships in South Africa. And routinely, this is what I'm finding. You got people with their hands on the levers of change,
yeah,
and a level of optimism to create change. And really, I don't mind if the intentionality is positive change. If they want to fuck shit up, as it was played back to me, then I don't mind.
What level of fucking shit up should one go for? Because, I mean, you mentioned the suffragettes, and I think between like 1912, 1914, they went through this whole aspect of civil disobedience, mm-hmm. and to the point where I think they showed it in the suffragettes movie that one of them like threw herself in front of King George's horse and died a few days later. Emily Davidson. What is the extent in which you rebel,
yeah.
and where is the line drawn? Where do you say no? Because everybody can be quite... Mm-hmm. Like, you don't know, because as much as you want to protect people and you yeah. want to go out and make change, it will somehow, in that moment, harm someone. We always talk about maybe pirates in hindsight. We say, that was a pirate. Yeah. But in the moment, they're a rebel and they're messing things up for us.
Yep. So this is so I'm going to just amplify that question to your listeners, really.
Actually. Yeah.
So wherever you are, falling asleep or on a run or not paying full attention, like... Pay attention for a second. This question, I think, is profoundly important. When will you know that it is the right time to break the rules?
Yeah.
Because it's not always the right time to break rules because people get hurt. It's not always the right time to kick off in the street because there might not be the meaning behind it. You might be the one that gets in the most trouble. But history tells us again and again that those who broke the rules and the laws of the day, mm-hmm. who were criminals of the hour, or even yeah. terrorists, become the heroes of the next day. Right?
Yeah.
Many of our heroes in their moment. And we also know, as we look back, those who were just following orders, we judge very dimly.
Harshly, yeah.
We live in historic times. There is no question of that. What is going to go down in your lifetime? Significant life events are going to go down. There isn't any question of that. We just saw, 6 million people migrate around Europe because of conflict. We're going to see, a minimum estimate, 20 million migrations because of environmental degradation. We're back to the brink of thermonuclear war. You know, we didn't escape economic collapse. We've just pushed it out a little bit. There's
another one soon coming.
There's too many. There's too many options, right?
Yeah.
So in those times, and with the leaders that you've got, when will you know if it is upon you? It's the right time to break the rules. I think it's a really important, sincere and historic question of the moment. And are you ready for it? So I think there is, yes, a risk. Absolutely a risk.
Yeah.
And I think you need to know, I ask the question in the book, I ask it in the workshops that I run. What values do you have that you hold so dear that you would fight for them, that you would hit someone and you'd take a punch for them, you know, that you'd risk your job for them, that you'd risk what matters to you?
Or take a bullet like Malala, like you said in the book.
Yeah. I think it's time for us to really ask those questions of ourselves, because I wouldn't be surprised if you're asked in a serious manner, and when you are, I want you to be ready.
Yeah. There was a tweet somebody put out the other day, just to follow on what you said. They're like, how many podcasts, how many books, how many blog posts, how many... what was the other thing? How many talks are you going to go to? How many
workshops are
you
going
to go to before you actually start what you actually say you're going to start? I think that's important. But what perspective do you have on our generation from somebody looking outward in? What do you think about what we're doing and about what a lot of people are? Do you think there's a... Is there a conflict there that you think, or do you think that we're not moving as quickly? What do you, from what you see, what are you looking at?
Do you think we'll all talk?
Do you think we'll all talk?
I don't. I mean, I'll answer that after you.
I mean, but, why are you answering it?
I mean, I won't answer it, but I'm rebelling. Yeah, man, I'm rebelling on Sam. That.
Sam.
No, Sam, you go ahead, because.
No, you started with a thought. I think it's important.
No, my issue is I feel like we are being very, like, there is an injustice on our. Because I see some of our generation, you know, we get called the snowflake generation because we're always offended about everything.
We melt easily.
Yeah. And I question whether it's actually us who are tacitly complying to the structures, or whether it's the 40-year-old baby boomer range who are doing that rather than us. I mean, of course, there are many of us. Like, for example, I'm very... When I was reading your book and you were talking about rebellion, I'm naturally somebody that likes rules. And so when I was reading it...
Like in financial regulation, don't you?
Not financial reg, but, you know, but so...
You guys are so mean. But I like rules. Since I was a child, I was a very obedient child. And breaking them, I see the value in them, and I almost encourage it, but it's actually not my natural state.
I don't think it's, you know, many people's natural.
And so when I was reading your book, it was really reading me to filth, because it was saying, what are you doing? You need to, you know. And so I think last week we talked about accepting ideologies, and we had that whole rant on do we rebel stuff, do we accept it, and I think that breaking rules and becoming pirates, or pirates in of themselves, awaken us from the slumber of the society in which we're living in. But then I don't know to the extent that it's us doing that per se.
So I think you've got to ask yourselves the honest question. I think the grown-ups, let's say now, you know, the kind of classic tier of 55-year-old white men.
Yeah.
Who mainly... And what's that stat? There's more blokes called Jack and the CEOs of the Fortune 500.
Oh, my God.
Women or something. You know, that kind of generation is a bottleneck of progress at the moment.
Yeah.
And it served relatively well, as capitalism did for the latter half of the 20th century. You know, on the whole, we invented computers and the internet and better things, and moved a billion people out of poverty. But as I say in the book, I think I think we've left the fridge door open, and that shit's gone off, and now it needs another upgrade.
Exactly.
As we have before.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a complex place, and I have some sympathy for that tier, because they don't really know what to do. You know, they've read the books, they've seen the blogs, they've seen you guys coming. They're like, yeah, we need radical change and disruption, man.
We need diversity.
Exactly. And they're, you know, desperately trying to get to grips with it, and they know that, you know, whatever industry they're in, you know, the industries that haven't had their Weinstein Me Too moment are, you know, planning to deal with the fallout of theirs, because it's coming.
Yeah.
Like, music industry is coming, for the advertising industry it's coming, you know. Those practices were commonplace, not just in movies, right, of course. And that was the norm then. That's not the norm for your generation. I think your generation is accelerating. I think there is something different. I think you're living it out. I mean, who told you to start a podcast? Who told you to become, you know, as influential as you are? Who told you to do something that the whole publishing industry kind of has fallen around and has got all eyes on you and wants to know what you're going to do next with it, right? Nobody, I imagine, told you to do this. And what you demonstrate in this sense of enterprise or rebellion or piracy, as I would call it, will create ripples. Is not the rest of the publishing industry trying to pull their shit together about their podcast strategy? Do what those guys are doing. I mean, how many publishers have you got on the phone, right? So you're having an influence. That's the way pirates create change. They cause trouble at the edges, and then over time, it influences the centre. And you know you've been successful when the centre thinks it's their idea, and it won't be as cool as yours, but it will have created a sense of movement. So I think it is essential, because I don't think the change or the solutions that we've currently got are close to the weight and the scale of the problems that we've got.
How do you feel about pirates reacting to other pirates and somebody having a particular type of thought, questioning it, seeing it move forward, getting to a certain solution, and then another pirate comes along to question that?
Yeah.
How do those two minds interact with each other to ensure that there is a sort of a harmonious flow? Or do we need a harmonious flow? Do we need more conflict? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer that we do. I think we are so... Conflict is such a taboo. We find it so hard. I think publishing finds it hard. You know, lots of industries find it hard to have a good, frank disagreement. But usually, out of conflict, better things come. Piracy's role in the evolution and innovation in capitalism is to challenge, right? A new territory is discovered, or there's been market failure in one.
Mm.
You know, publishing wasn't necessarily delivering, it had an easy life, and ebooks come along and threaten it, so it pulls its socks up, you know, and
together,
you saw a lot
of
innovation in publishing happen.
Yeah.
You saw it in, you know, the pirate radio, right? If Radio Caroline hadn't sailed half a mile outside of legal waters and started broadcasting, and very quickly had a third of the country finally listening to some decent music. I mean, it's the 1960s, and all you had was two radio stations from the BBC, and just imagine like the level of gardening shows or whatever it was. And so pirate radio broke the monopoly of the BBC. Mm. Within years, there were five channels.
Yeah.
So it creates necessary... Through those conflicts, we get better outcomes. You wouldn't have... You know, we're going to come to Steve Jobs later as well.
Mm.
Favorite Steve Jobs line: He was brought in by the assembled heads of the world's biggest music label in the face of music piracy to help them come up with a solution. But they weren't seeing the opportunity. He tells them famously to get their heads out of their arses.
One and of my favorite parts of the book,
yeah,
actually.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I love that whole piracy bit. It's great. Yeah.
and so that's it. If we can reshift our idea that these Caribbean pirates weren't just bloodthirsty rogues, and there is a bit of that. I'm not shying away from it. But actually they're social revolutionaries, then we can perhaps begin to understand that the notion of piracy is a positive driver of innovation and change.
Mm.
And then perhaps we can say to your generation, look, guys, these dudes in charge, whilst they're saying the right stuff, aren't going to make change as quick as that might need to happen. And perhaps you need to break a few more rules. Perhaps you need to kick in a few more doors. Perhaps this podcast is a good start, but you know, maybe next time you take over the Penguin podcast, you know, lock yourself in the Penguin podcast. How many listeners do they have?
A lot. Thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah.
So, next Mostly Lit podcast. If we're going to really do a Mostly Pirate podcast, you can get the keys, probably.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Why not?
Right, fine. Let's do the second...
Rock up there and be like, hi, so let's do, record.
We'll do the second half of this one in there.
I love it.
We record an hour's talk. Get the best guest you can, someone, you know, more than me.
Someone like Sam.
Or get someone who wouldn't get that exposure. That's the best way to do it. Get someone who wouldn't get that exposure, get the keys, record that podcast, and then flip the files just before it goes out. That's the kind of shit that you could be doing and getting away with in the positions that you are that would only, you know, benefit Penguin in the long run. And over time, perhaps Penguin then go, wow, you know, we need more diversity on our podcast. Mm. Actually, you know, two for celebrities and Stephen Fry's, and then one for someone new. These are the kind of rules I'm advocating.
You've begun. Your civil disobedience.
There's more to be done.
Tell us about your own piracy mission that you went to. So I heard that you went to Waterstones. And
now, this was hilarious.
Because when I saw the picture, I was like, what did you do?
I just had this picture of you running down Piccadilly trying to escape the booksellers. Trying to dive down
criminal.
To the
criminal.
You know what? It's just the kind of innate pirate sense of mind. And that's why I do, you know, I'm advocating a break a rule a day so you can get into the habit.
Yeah.
I like this. I think I'm going to do this. Yeah.
Find one that feels just a bit uncomfortable. It's got to feel a bit uncomfortable.
I might text the boy twice.
There you go.
So what Sam...
The world hasn't ended. Then maybe try something else.
Right?
What Sam did was he went in and took his book and he put it into the... Into the
book that is not out yet.
Not out yet. He took his copies of the book and he put it into the display window.
He put it in a display window at Waterstones. Was it Piccadilly?
The flagship, yeah. And they had all... There's, you know, Jordan B. Peterson's The 12 Rules of Life or something is out.
Yeah.
And, you know, absolute respect. He's selling tons and he's just sold out the Hammersmith Apollo or something. And I'm sure it's a brilliant book, but it's kind of the business book that I'm slightly standing against. You know, the classic Times New Roman white font bloke stands up and tells you how smart he is. Thank you very much, bloke. And so I just replaced all of those in the Penguin reception. It wasn't actually my idea. There's a pirate within Penguin who's...
Oh.
So we did that together.
So that's what you need to have. You need to have someone inside. Okay.
The pirates inside. So that was just in my mind. And then I was walking between meetings. I went past Waterstones. And I like to go in there every now and then and just say, do you have a book called Be More Pirate coming out? You know, just to, you know.
I can see you hobbling in and like your peg leg.
And just have the board meeting. Like, so they have a book. Everyone's asking for this book. Who is it?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of middle-aged white blokes who's coming in asking for this one book. No, right, seriously, at the earliest stage of the process, I've had a really great experience. I purposely didn't take on an agent. I really wanted to learn. And at one stage, in my ambition, so I went to the publishers, the printers, I saw the books come off the press. You know, the guys at Penguin have been tireless and brilliant at letting me understand each process, even when I've really exhausted them.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go into Waterstones. So I marched into Waterstones one day, just started a conversation with the manager. Hello, you know, what happens with a book?
Yeah.
It was, fuck you. And it was great in the end. But tell me this one thing. Do you know, you may know this, you're working in the industry.
How many
books on average does Waterstones order for a new author with a new title?
I would like to know that, actually. I don't think we know. But
well, let's have a guess. Let's have a prize.
So,
this Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ask the question again. How many
Waterstones?
Mm-hmm.
You know them well. As a rule of thumb,
right?
For Be More Pirate, how many books on average do you think they would order per store for a new book from a new author of Be More Pirate?
I want to say 1,000.
I want to say 50
per store. 350. Rasheen,
come on, Rasheen, spit it out.
Five.
Okay.
Four. Wow.
I'll say 25.
Oh, I said 1,000, but I'm a bit too 50. Optimistic.
One.
Wait, so there's a new book that's coming out from a new author,
yeah.
And they put one book in the store.
One per store.
So you're trying to tell. So, okay. Oh, wow.
Well, you'll get this for the math point of view, right? So that's what it defies the logic.
It's ridiculous.
What do you do? If it sells well, then we'll get on. How do you know if it sells well? You've sold one, right?
It's like, exactly.
We sold out. You know, that's the maths don't.
That makes no sense.
I know, it doesn't correspond. So.
So you can just go and buy your own book just to get more delivered.
Oh yes. So I've been popping into different Waterstones, and it turns out there's quite a lot of nuances to it that the different store managers have an impact on there. So just in every single stage of this book, I've tried to take the lessons that I'm putting forward and live now. I left my job. You know, I've put myself all in to this. I've broken every single rule we can along the way. We were talking about Blinkist earlier on. So as soon as I was told not to talk to Blinkist, I picked up the phone to Blinkist. I'm doing a really great partnership with them to find out what we can do in the stores. And so there I was in... taking pictures of Jordan B. Peterson with my book in front, tweeting at Jordan B. Peterson saying, we're coming for you, man.
You are incredible.
Just to see what he's got to say about it.
Did he say anything? Cool. He's not a pirate.
Yeah. So I just popped into Waterstones and thought, I wonder what it's going to look like. You know, Waterstones has got that funny genre called smart thinking, which is a little bit...
Oh, yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
Slightly uncomfortable. But nonetheless, that's where I want to be.
Okay.
So I was just sticking it on top of Seth Godin and Malcolm Gladwell and just all the places that I'd like to shut up. Here you go. And then I saw there was the window. And I thought, I wonder what it looks like in the window. So I just leant over and started making an arrangement. And then I'd better get some pictures from outside. died. And, and then I was taking some out of the window, moving around. And obviously, that by that point, it looked like I was stealing the books. And the guys had to chase. And, you know, they... It's quite a scary thing to chase a shoplifter. I mean, I don't look like a shoplifter, do I? Like a young Tory. And they were doubly confused. David Cameron stealing books. Chasing me out all red-faced. What do you think you're doing?
Oh, my God, wow.
I feel like you're the funniest guest we've had.
It was really good.
That's bizarre.
Wow. I think I'm going to do that. Because I don't... like I
change
I,
the books.
No, not that. Just like the concept of... if you want to see it, just do it.
Disruption.
Yeah,
disruption.
Just and it makes me feel uncomfortable because I like
order.
And you know me, whenever like there's something that needs to be cleaned up, like, oh God, I need to clean it up to make it look like pretty and perfect. And I think this is why I argue with Derek a lot, because Derek is not an orderly person. I'm sorry to bring you up, mate, but you're not.
No, go ahead, mate.
But you're a pirate, so I really respect that. And I think you're very important for the show, because anything happens, I'm like... you'll interrupt it.
He's really giving me a compliment.
I know, I am.
Can't believe it.
But,
I don't know
what's
going on here. I feel like, wow.
No, but it's true. So,
it's a moment.
Wow, I feel like this is a learning curve.
It's because you're here, Sam. She's not usually like this.
It's going well. I think this is necessary upon you guys. I think that the next few years... what is the absolute only certainty that you were saying, someone with my years can share? The only certainty that you can be completely sure of is total uncertainty. Nobody knows what's going to come next. Nobody predicted
that. Fills me with dread.
It should fill you with dread. No one is coming to save you. No one knows what they're doing. The leadership of the world currently, who are your biggest leaders, do not have a master plan. Sadly, I've found this at every stage of my career, right? You get higher and higher up and you kind of think, top, there'll be someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in various boardrooms, and rarely do you find the CEO that's actually got their shit together. I found myself in Downing Street, you keep hoping that there's a secret cupboard full of really smart ninjas
and all the answers.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
They are not there. The leadership that your world has for the next few years, for sure, is deeply worrying and does not have a master plan that isn't really about sustaining their own circumstances. So, A, there's a necessity to be ready to break some rules. B, changes are coming. All sorts of uncertainty is coming. You know how thin the financial stability it is based on our whole world. The rules that we've got are so thin.
Very.
You know, the last time there were riots on our streets, what did it actually take for that to kick off?
It took a death.
Paper thin. And once it starts, everyone realises how close they are to... once it starts, it will start. So you need to be... ready for a bit more resilience. And I don't just mean resilience like mental health and wellbeing, which is of course important. I mean resilience for like a life living in changing times.
Whew. How do we maintain our mental health and wellbeing in those kind of
situations? I think it just gets you through,
here comes Alex with the wellness.
I know, but like I feel like in tumultuous times, you find something in you. The thing is, I think we forget is there is this inner strength for endurance of both mental and physical change. But because we haven't used that endurance so much, we forget that it's there, and we forget how to be resilient and tenacious and to... Do you know what I mean?
Or there's just this general malaise that happens.
Yeah. And that slumber that we're so used to, that comfort that you mentioned is everywhere. And
yeah, I mean, I do agree with that. I think that the rise in mental health amongst young people can't be coincidence or disconnected from the other rises, the rise in social media, the rise in this kind of sense of purposelessness. Did you see the Prince's Trust report? It was the percentage of young people that don't believe there is a meaning to their lives was terrifying. It was your age, it was 12 to 14. It was horrendous. And that really represents the kind of the underlying reasons of mental health. And I think in times of great uncertainty, when it's upon us, you find your way through. But in the rest of it, when you're just allowing the malaise to occur and we're not part of anything, then of course the mind begins to wander or unravel.
Are you fearless?
Are you fearless?
I think that's a good question.
That's a good question.
Given the context, I was thinking about this and I thought... At the beginning of the conversation, I thought to myself, when Ray, you talk about the limitations, how far do you take it?
Mm-hmm.
I thought, in order to be a pirate, realistically, you have to have some cojones. Like, you really need to be, like, really fearless. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of, in the book, when you're talking about you know, pirate radio, or when you're talking about when they set up like LimeWire and those kind of things, these people have to be quite fearless, because if they get caught, they're going to jail, they're going to prison. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or like when you talk about Malala, like she was risking death, like they could have killed her. And sometimes
they shot her once.
This is what I mean.
And she survived.
Yeah, and she survived. And this is why sometimes I think with like the social media age and us, you know, online activism and stuff like that, sometimes I just think when shit gets real,
where are you?
What's going to happen? Mm. Like, what, do you know what I mean? What are we going to do? Mm.
We've been very protected. We've been living in a society. Yeah, and
sometimes I think, how do you cultivate that fearlessness? Like, is it specific to some people? Are some people just more pirate than others?
Well, I think
is pirateness innate?
I think it can be a habit. I think, yes, there are some people who are kind of hardwired to be rule breakers, and I'm probably one of them. I think, you know, I've always been an entrepreneur. I've only had two real jobs. And I realised halfway through the book that I was just a bit too much in my own bubble of, yeah, we're social entrepreneurs, we'll change the world, yeah.
Hmm.
And in the small groups that I was working on, because I was so adamant that this book was for the, you know, as I get old, so multiple stories going on there. So I knew with Liberty, one of the reasons I started writing the book to answer the question that we began on, why was I doing it?
Yeah.
I knew it was time for me to begin to move on. I knew, and I'd had this joke for a long while, that when I hit 40, I'd be too old to run a youth project. And that's principally what Liberty does, works with and supports young people. And I didn't want to be that like 42-year-old guy saying, yes, waste man, you know. And it was just like too cringy.
The dub play drama's coming through now. Yeah.
Dub play drama's all right though, man. I was in my 20s.
Listen, that's
you were in
that's
your 20s, wow.
That's a cultural monument, man, dub play drama. If that came out now,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? People would go crazy for it. Absolutely crazy for it. Yeah.
Reboot.
The other day, me and Luke Hyams, who was the originator, who's now the head of originals at, in fact, I just introduced to him the other day. It was the point we sat down to talk about what Dubplate would look like now.
Yeah.
And how that would look, and had some quite interesting ideas. So, I thought it was upon me to make sure that Liberty stays true and authentic to itself, which is one of the reasons I was listening to Why I'm Not Talking to White People. And you start to begin a journey where all that comes around. I knew that I needed to make a shift. And in the notion of this book, I needed to know that I had that same authenticity. So that's why I was in Athens. That's why I was in Baltimore, you know, testing this book. So it wasn't this 41-year-old, this is my legacy project there, being benevolent to these children, you know, exactly the person I'm talking against. So I road tested the hell out of it to know that the workshops, the questions were useful and real. And then at the end of it, I began to realise that the majority of people are not pirates. They're working in large organisations. They're completely conditioned to break the rules. They kind of like the idea of pirates, but by God, that's not what I want to do every day. And then the thing that you just said. So I widened the aperture of the book a lot. And what I think is that nobody is fearlessness. You know, I think that's borderline, you know, personality disorder, probably. But actually, if every single day you're pushing yourself, then you're gonna learn what your capacity is for it. And I've pushed myself enough times to know that if I do this in Waterstones, I'm going to do it with some respect. I'm not going to take the piss out of anyone. I'm not going to hurt anyone.
Yeah.
But we will have some fun. I'll probably, you know, hopefully raise a few more rebellious laughs and we'll go somewhere good. Okay, fine. So that doesn't scare me.
Hmm.
And the same with the pirate radio guys. You know, they knew ultimately they were doing something good. They were meeting a need and they were going to do something great. And was that worth risking, you know, being locked up? Probably. But you know, so you make an informed decision, you do the right thing. And that's what I think the pirates are. They're just rampantly going out anarchically murdering people. It's not clockwork orange.
Doing something civil.
It's doing something that you believe in. Well, and that's the question. What values do you have that you'd be willing to take a risk for? You protect those values, or you fight for those values, or you're proactive in championing those values. Take a risk, and the interesting thing is the following day, the world hasn't stopped. You know, your bruise will go down, it will be all right, and you become more and more experienced. It's just like any other skill. The more times you've done it, the better you get at it. And that will just mean that your growth is faster, your trajectory is further.
You flex your pirate muscle.
If you want to continue in the world you're in with MPRH, you know, you're going to get away with a lot more knowing just how far you can push it and the rules that you can break. Because the rules that you've been given aren't that good. You know, you've inherited a dodgy set of rules, guys. And it's due and it's upon you to start rewriting them. So that begins with breaking them. So get comfortable with it.
In all of this, in all of the ups and downs and the fearlessness and the challenges and stuff. Do you find that you're happier that way? Do you find it's really, we wake up every morning and just think, mm-hmm. I'm content doing all this. I don't have to worry about any of...
Yeah, this is the red pill, blue pill question.
The strip, like, you know, do you find that?
So there's this quote that I love from Captain Flint, who's a pirate. We teach our children to be scared of the shadows, and in the darkness, terrible things lie. But truly, in the darkness lies freedom, liberation, and power. I really believe in that.
Mm.
I think we've given ourselves this. You know, there's never not a bogeyman, is there? There's never not the thing that we should all be wary of. And yeah, the more I find liberation, the more you can try and be true to yourself, the further you go, and yeah, the happier you are. My wife, to get personal, I met her in 2007 on June the 30th, actually. And after knowing me for a little while, and Liberty was growing, and I've always been very invested in young people, mentoring, lots of other things, she said, "Why do you spend so much time trying to make other people happy when you're not happy yourself?" And she saw right through me, and she saw this kind of savior complex that I had, trying to put things right. And no single person probably has done more to help me face the more difficult questions and understand who you really are, and that in that space, which is often dark, right? You're often scared of many of those things, of who we really are, or ashamed of what that might be, or the judgments that the world has put upon us, or the prejudices, and all of that stuff. But yeah, the closer you are, the more comfortable you are with your shitty true self, probably the happier you wake up.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's a perfect way to end this section.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate that. Yeah,
I like that. I'm very inspired.
My wife will laugh right through me. You're not bloody true with yourself. But she's taking me on a journey.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. Well, that's been our discussion on Be More Pirate.
Be More Pirate, guys.
Well, we haven't even started.
We haven't even started.
I know. Right.
Touched on.
Okay. Wow.
I'd like to say one last thing.
Yes, one last thing.
You said you had questions.
Yeah, you had your questions.
I know.
We're going to go to Messy Flicks, but go for it.
Book is out on Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes on the horizon for me.
Ooh.
If you think Waterstones was causing trouble.
Ooh. You're going to give us a flood of piracy.
Giving us that mischievous grin, like.
I'm recruiting you. Recruit.
I can't believe he called himself looking like a young Tory.
Early in the morning, I'm going to be raising a flag, and I will ask you to help me wave it in the direction of more pirates.
Okay.
We're ready.
We're down.
Good to have you aboard.
Gonna.
Okay, so
for Mostly Flicks, guys, this week we watched just to kind of add on to the topic of pirates and piracy. We watched Steve Jobs, starring Michael Fassbender.
You did, and I directed.
Yeah,
I've watched this movie like 4 times.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
I watched it in the cinema like 3 times.
That was the homework. Even I watched it.
Hey,
thank you.
Okay, first of all, home at 3 a.m. yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm shocked you haven't watched it. I thought you would have watched it when it came out.
I know, it was literally on the. I was going to, and then yeah. I didn't. And then Clarissa was like, "You really love Fassbender?" I love Fassbender.
Yeah,
I mean, he's like. Really fine.
My wife loves Sam Fassbender.
Right?
I've woken up in the morning and she's told me I've just been having a dream about Fassbender.
Oh my God.
I love Fassbender.
Mainly as Magneto, though. Mm.
So. Oh, right.
Yeah. He's great as Magneto.
I mean, the film was good.
I like him in Jane Eyre. I'm sorry.
The film was good. It's on Netflix, guys. Check it out. But I felt like what were the key things that you guys picked up from that film, because the way that his character was so narcissistic.
The film was so I was surprised at how honest the film was about him. Like, he's an arsehole. Clearly he's an arsehole. But he was a genius. Like, there's this great scene where he's talking to Steve Watney and
Wozniak.
And then he basically just is kind of like, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, and he's just like, I play the orchestra.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I feel like that is the perfect, like, phrase for, like, management and how to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's also very arrogant, of course it is. Like, I don't know how to do anything, but you guys do, that's fine. And I'll show you how to
put it together.
That. Yeah, exactly.
That's me.
Hmm? Is that you?
Is it?
Okay. Oh,
cool. Shut up, Alex.
Yeah, I think one of the standout things about it was also the fact that like, even though Steve was saying that, oh, you don't know how to code, you don't know how to do this, you don't know how to do that, and he's like, you know, this, you're the only one who cares that it's a perfect cube, it's gonna fail. And he's like, well, tell me something I don't know. And it's like, this, like, he's a genius because he can predict what is going to happen and how this is all going to end.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? He doesn't need to know how to do anything because he has foresight.
Yeah.
He could see that people are going to start shaking. They're going to buy him out.
Kate Winslet is in it, isn't she?
Yeah.
There's a lot of big names in it.
Okay.
And I thought, just watching it, it's really inspiring watching it.
Yeah, it was interesting how they came up with the ideas, like certain things that he saw. Like, obviously with his daughter, and he was like, I'm tired of seeing you walking around with this Walkman. Like, I'm gonna have 50 songs, 100 songs, 1,000 songs, anything in your pocket, but not this big clunky piece of crap that you're walking around with. Mm. And then obviously we have the iPod, and then that's revolutionized the way everybody listens to music now, and all these different things. And there was even what was it called? The network, the Newton.
Oh,
which was the notepad stylus.
Yeah.
And he was just like, it failed because you have a stylus when there's five styluses on your hand. Like,
it was obviously, what did you think though? Because I think he did a really good job of portraying what a total arsehole he was.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, he was, I mean, worse than an arsehole. He denied his child. Pretty much abuse, right? That's neglect and abuse of his child. He purposefully did the deal on a different day so that he'd get out of paying his wife money. You know, he bullied the hell out of people. He didn't give people credit for the ideas they came up with, and yet he's still, you know, I think the fact that he's a, you know, intelligent white man gets him away with a lot of stuff that would be completely, you know, unacceptable. And yet he's just such a genius. And he just does it so bloody well that he still, ultimately, the duality of it, I thought, was brilliant. I thought the film captured the duality really well, because I've read the book, and I think everyone ends up being a bit sycophantic about Steve Jobs. And I've got a quote from him.
I'm
all in.
What's the quote? The quote is, I'd rather be a pirate than join the Navy.
No one has given me permission for to put on the front of that book. And of all the conversations we had around the beautiful book and the artwork and not having a title on the cover and not having my name and all these great things, and there's brilliant debates and discussions, and I'm very grateful to the Team Penguin for letting that get through, because there aren't many books that don't have a title on them.
Yeah.
But rule breaking had to be part of it. The fact that we got Steve Jobs' quote, no one even questioned, because we were arguing about everything else so much. But I really saw that duality for the point that we were saying earlier on in him, and I found it really uncomfortable, because he was just a total C unit. Again and again, I still have respect for him. I still walk around with an Apple phone.
Yeah.
And I will never leave. I complain about it all the time.
One thing that I really thought was, it was kind of like how audacious he was, like the fact that he wanted it to be a closed loop. I still find that so annoying that I can't plug regular headphones into my iPhone. It pisses me off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, but we'll still go out and buy the adapter to plug in. And, do you know?
But
what
you
I mean?
Could do that before,
huh?
You could do that before.
Yeah, but you can't do it now.
But then, but you don't have to have the Apple Bluetooth. You could just use the Bluetooth headphones.
But what, that's his whole... So, you know, when he comes back...
It's just like...
He accuses Wozniak of messing the company up, and they were making everything open. And he was like, absolutely everything is closed. He's kind of, in a way, the antithesis of the technology movement, making open principles, and in some way, pirate principles, of complete control and mastery of that brand. And I think it's because he has such an ego that he knows better than anyone else. And that's... And it was interesting that he is in denial the whole time. When anybody says, you know, this is weird, you know, you're playing out your issues... And the kind of father relationship he has with Jeff Daniels, which I find weird, because I just think he look like Jeff Daniels.
Oh my god! That's who it was.
And you know, the whole thing about him calling it Lisa and whatever, but he's kind of in such denial. He's so far on the spectrum that he can't even recognise that these are, you know, him acting out those issues.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to go and watch
Syrian
it.
Syrian refugee. That was part of the story.
That did kind of come quite quickly and go quite quickly.
Yeah, they make time, but really, I mean, for the context of the times we're in, it's a really important.
It is a,
he was adopted. He was given up for adoption quite early.
One thing I didn't notice, I watched in the cinema when it came out, and this time around I noticed something different, was, and maybe it goes to your point, Derek, about the craft of the machines, was the craft of the film. Like, obviously, as you know, Aaron Sorkin, who I think would make A Chat with a Taxi Driver, you know, into a movie, it's such good stuff, and Danny Boyle, I think their contrasting styles comes across really well. But It looked to, I mean, it looked like it, and I checked it, so I'll tell the truth. But the grade changed as the film goes on. And it's because they shoot, you know, it's three different eras.
Yeah.
They shot the first one in 16mm, they shot the second one in 35mm, and they shot the final one in digital.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Which is just such a lovely bit of detailed storytelling that kind of helps move you through the aesthetic and then the time.
Yeah.
Mm. It kind of made me think about what it would have been like being at that point in 1984 or 3 or whenever it was. Like in the 80s. When,
84 is when it was
released. Yeah, when they were starting off, like the Apple, well, not starting off, but they were kind of in the throes of the Apple Mac and Macintosh and Apple Apple II and all these different things. It kind of made me think, like, what would that have been like? Like, this, all this innovation, all these new... Now we're so ingrained in Apple, like, you won't go far. I mean, I've got an Apple Watch, and then, you know, we've all got iPhones and a MacBook and all these things. Like, we have all these things.
Mm.
Yeah, I do remember it. I do remember it, like, early... Yeah. Like, I do remember it. But then it's like, now, at this point where we're at now, we're so fully in it. Like...
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't even have to be alive to know that.
Interesting. So I'm old enough to maybe not quite remember when it came, but 1984 is the year that famous advert hit, and it's a very interesting year in terms of consumerism. It was the first time the Olympics was ever sponsored. It's when Material Girl, you know, is the height of human kind of consumer culture. And at that point, they were the
84. Wow.
And the advert was kind of based on Orwell. And smashing.
Yeah.
And we all really got into Apple's young, because it was the outside of the rebel. Do you, as a younger generation, do you consider Apple as a rebellious brand or as the institution? Do you think it's the pirates or the Navy?
It's the Navy. It's what I would go for. As in, I...
No.
For me, I
wouldn't say it's the Navy. I would say that...
As in, right now,
depends on how you use it. Depends on how you use it. Okay. I feel like there are things within Apple product, like, I think the way they've marketed it as well. Like, if you're somebody who likes... If you're a creative person and if you like to, you know, be able to do really cool things, like technologically wise,
what you're saying, it's if you like to be pirate.
Pardon?
Is that what you're trying to, like, if you want to be a pirate?
Yeah, if you want to do things, you know that, and you know that someone's doing it with an Apple, I feel like, for some reason.
But I think,
whereas on a PC there are limitations. I do feel.
But the thing, though, I think the way that Apple...
restricted on a PC.
I think the way Apple started, just going back to what you asked, I think this is how it always is. Things start off as rebellion, and somehow it turns into the status quo. Like, it really gets like, you know, we're in 15 million units in that Black Mirror episode where he's rebelling. He's got the sharp thing to his neck,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually he's got his own TV show where he's got the thing to his neck.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was reading about Dadaism, like the anti art movement. Mm. And things like punk and grime and stuff like that, where it's like, we're anti-establishment,
but we become the establishment.
Part of the establishment. Right. And I think that's what's happened with Apple as well.
Absolutely. Like, for example, I don't do much with computers. With me, it's, I need a computer to go and either write something or literally limited use. And I don't think, let me get a Toshiba or whatever. I think, well, I'm going to get a Mac, because like a MacBook. And literally, when I think of computers, I think of Apple. I don't think of...
Really?
That's
strange. I think of a PC. I never think
of
a
MacBook. Yeah,
really? I think of a MacBook.
I had a PC.
Like, even when, like, at universities, when I was at university, we're all, like, sitting down and people will just... everyone will have a Mac.
I think the Mac...
Before you get into Mac versus PC, you said, I'm going to ask you some questions, and I'd like to build on that point
about
how you create change, because I have a question for you about how you create change.
Right.
So, the pirate... What defines pirates, when you say, is that a bit more... pirate rate as Apple, is because what I'm defining it as is breaking a rule to remake a rule, the rewriting of rules. That's what I think is upon you. So, congratulations, you guys, you've reached this position of power and influence. You've made this very successful show, which is really beautifully made and has an avid listenership and a very influential one.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your place on the Future Book list.
Thank you.
The industry is looking at you. To draw on another highbrow literary reference, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. How do you view your responsibility, and what are you going to do with it?
You know what, just get young people reading. I think that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. What we're responsible for is getting more books into people's hands. And it's one of the reasons why I've got my young mentee, Rashan, here. We've made a couple references to him, and I think people are probably thinking,
who's that?
Talking about. Yeah, but we've got. Yeah, now nah, he's too shy. Rashan, you want to. Nah, he's too shy. But yeah, it's what just. I got him some Mallory Blackman book. I got him Holes as well.
Nice.
I don't know how far he is through. I need to catch up with him about that. But yeah, I think it's just about putting more books into young people's hands. I'm really focused on getting young black boys reading, because obviously, as we see, it's usually, I mean, people always say, oh, you black people read, blah, blah, blah. But look, young black boys are not reading as much as other people. And I think they can really benefit from it. Do you know what I mean? In terms of helping them understand their positions in the world and, you know, developing a better kind of empathy. Like, I talk to some of my cousins and I say things to them, and they're just looking at me like, what are you talking about? Like, I've never been here. Like, I was walking along the Thames with my friend Adrian, and he was just like, he's like 20 odd, and he was just like, Rod, you know, man's never been here before, you know, like he's never like, obviously, you know, as Londoners, we never go and do like sightseeing things and whatnot and all that kind of thing. But it's just like, I've never even thought to come out here. Like, do you know what I mean? And I think, yeah, reading literature can give people the opportunity to
critique the world.
Yeah, and want to explore more. It gives it creates a curiosity. And I think that's really important as well. I think that's one of our responsibilities, to be honest.
I think that our responsibility is, not, I don't know if it's a responsibility, but it's providing a space whereby we can talk about the world that we live in a way that isn't monitored, in a way that isn't overseen by a hierarchy that tells us this is how you're supposed to do things. Because I'm always conscious, and I'm like always ranting to the boys whenever we do have, like, I don't know, like sponsorship or whatever. My biggest thing is our content needs to be unfiltered. It needs to not have restrictions. Yep. So when we like are working with people, that is my main thing, is if I want to say something, I will say it. I don't care if you're paying me for it. I don't care if you're not paying me for it. Yep. And allowing that space where people can talk about things in a way that is critiquing the world, in a way that is important, as well as ensuring that people who don't have a voice are given a voice. Mm-hmm. So, like, a lot of guests that we have had on the show have been people that I would say, like, especially in our, like, you know, in our like first few episodes, the guests that we've had on are people that are not always given the platform, the recognition, the money to be able to have a voice and to talk. And I feel like it's important for us to do that. So yeah, I feel like we're the underdog supporters. And I feel like we should continue to do that, like, regardless of how, like, when you say, oh, you know, you're like very influential and you know, you, congratulations on this, like, I guess because I'm not in the industry, I don't really see that.
I'm just like, you're safe.
Yeah, I literally, to me, I'm just like, oh, thank you. But in my head, it's like when people, like, I still go on like SoundCloud and I see listens, I'm like, why would anybody sit and listen to us talk this much rubbish? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So yeah,
that's a natural journey of a creator, and it's good to, you want to make sure you never lose that humility. I feel the same.
Yeah,
sit down with someone and they're like, oh, I enjoyed your book.
Really?
And I'm having a stranger experience than that, because I keep now running into people who've read the book and they're enacting some kind of rebellion, like, seriously, from the, you know, did Ed Miliband podcast the other day, and he totally rebelled and took a 10-minute episode and released it the next day. I've had a young woman who's campaigning to get her best friend released from Yarl's Wood, who's being illegally detained. I've got people who've contacted me saying, I'm resigning. You're like, there's an even another level. And so I share that to let you know that it would be irresponsible of you now to not recognise the responsibility that you have.
Yeah.
You do. And you have that responsibility as faces and voices that you've actively gone out to be in an industry that is particularly non-diverse, that is looking for change, and you now have that place of influence. So don't be too surprised by your listens anymore. Mm. And I ask the question with the great power you have, what comes next with the responsibility? Because I think it's upon you.
Yeah.
Alex, what's your view on it?
you've had time to think.
You've
so
had time to
you
think.
You were given some good answers.
We want wisdom. Mm.
Sorry, I've got a couple more questions.
I think that... time for wisdom. I don't know. I think that... As long as people listen and they take the genuineness that we're coming with, and the stories and the conversations that we're coming with, I think that's the main importance that we have. We're having the conversations, that a lot of people have never really had before. And I think that that's one of the few things that I think that's our responsibility, to have those conversations and to even just bring it up. And the more conversations we're having across industry-wide and just generationally, that's how we start to impact change and look at and try to create general different thoughts and collaborate and create new and great, wonderful things. So I think that's probably our responsibility that way. I mean, it marries the two, the young people and the underdogs, and it just helps us like see those changes happen. Because when it's an amazing thing for me when I see people respond and they're just like, oh, I listened to this, such and the other, and I really agree with what you said, or I bought this book, and I'm just like, wow, like, these are conversations that I've been having for a while, and I just wanted to bring it to here. So that's the responsibility.
Protecting that authenticity, I think, is absolutely key. Your point about not, you can't let your conversations with the industry that's going to get more excited about you influence what you do.
Yeah,
you need to be very careful, I would say, about any kind of paid relationships, you know, within the publishing industry as it continues.
And maybe absolutely
consider none, whilst I know you need to grow the sustainability of it in your careers. So I've got two more questions, but one of them is just building specifically on that point. So OECD did a large piece of research which found that unequivocally the biggest indicator of positive life outcomes when measured at 15 is a love and appreciation of literacy.
Mm.
If you can read, and not just be able to read, not just, you know, the A to B, but enjoy active participation in stories, because it links to identity and belonging and, you know, life, bigger than anything else, bigger than background of your parents, you know, bigger than income of your household income. So actually your point is really important. So how does this, you know, what more could be done by you as leaders, you know, of the industry that we're in, to get, because currently this country is way behind.
Yeah.
Way behind. We have shockingly low rates of literacy.
Yeah.
And teenagers, particularly teenage boys, and particularly young black teenagers. I mean, boys, you know, it gets worse and worse.
Mm.
So, yes, I completely agree. This is a set of authentic conversations. But as leaders in the publishing industry now, what more? If you had a budget, or if you knew that the chief execs were listening to the show, what would you say?
Go into schools.
Put us in schools. Yeah. Put us in workshops.
Literally. Like,
or just make content that will appeal to these people.
Yeah.
I think that's really... I think with a lot of companies and whatnot, they're quite detached. Like, they don't really know what to do. And a lot of the time, you hear these people talking about, you know, people in different businesses and whatnot, and they go to like the black person and say, how can we appeal to this audience? What do we need to do to appeal? Because they have no idea how to do it. So I think they won't even do that. Do you know what I mean? They'll just ask. They won't even pay someone. They'll ask someone, oh, can you help us do this and whatnot? And I think
they expect free.
Yeah, I think
as well,
what they should do is just kind of put more of us in these positions so we can then reach these people. Or once we have, like you're saying, we've got the power to influence now, try and do more of that. Like, do you know what I mean? So work on projects that appeal to these people and get these people, bring these people in. Once we're in a certain position, bring this person in or bring that person in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think there is this admiration and there's a desperation to look at the past and to just stay there and to not want to move forward. And I think that allows for the stagnation and that detachment that you talked about, Derek, of not being able to appeal to a certain group of people because you don't know what they do. Whilst you're very much stuck on, I don't know, if it's with regards to like schools, as you mentioned, you know, we're teaching people Shakespeare, and I love Shakespeare, but I can appreciate that the modern day young black guy, like young 15-year-old black boy, may not. And what are we putting on?
We can bring them Othello.
And what are we putting on their like roster and their like school table that will appeal to them and allow them to love literature? Because literature need not be so highbrow for it to be loved and for it to be persuasive and interesting. So why are we not putting Prisoners to the Streets in the bloody curriculum? Why are
it
we?
It is slowly.
Is it?
Yeah, it's been introduced into one school.
Though. Yeah, I saw that.
Well, do you know, it's those types of things. Those types of piracy type things that needs to be put on the curriculum for people, like young people, young 15-year-olds to love literature.
And I've got something up my sleeve as well.
Okay, Derek. I think things need to be modern. They need to appeal to people, and they need to come from a lived experience, not a learned experience. If you want to learn about a particular culture, a particular type of people, to be able to put something forward to them, why not get somebody who has lived it, who can give a more authentic view and can appeal to more people?
And has anyone ever got you into schools doing exactly what you've just proposed?
No.
Not yet. Not yet, though.
So should we try and put that right?
What are you doing?
I'm just looking up here. So I can see that Dame Julia Cleverdon is the chair of the National Literacy Trust.
Right.
She's a very nice woman. I've met her. She's a force of nature. And when Julia Cleverdon wants to get shit done, people listen. She marches them left, right and centre.
Are you sending her a message?
So, well, let's talk to your listeners.
Okay.
If you listen to the show and you think these wise guys should be in schools around the country, actually taking their message of literacy and empowerment and curiosity to the pupils of this country and getting them engaged. Mm. What we need behind us is probably someone like the National Literacy Trust who can make things happen. They can wield the power of the publishers and probably be the bridge between these guys being in school. So if you think that's the case, let's collectively start getting at Julia Cleverdon. I'm trying to find out her handle somewhere. Can't find it.
Tweet her.
Come on, Julia. Do your thing, girl.
It's the National Literacy Trust. They're definitely on Twitter. Okay, so they could be a good convening. They're a good convening group. So we get the National Literacy Trust.
Right.
Point to them, at them, link the podcast, link the guys, and let's start a conversation and see if pretty soon these three can't be in a room with that organisation. My part will be a follow-up today.
Yeah.
I'll send an email to them saying exactly what I've just heard you say, and there's a plan on the table waiting for them.
Amazing.
I like awesome. It.
Last question then. Building on that, so take it from the idea of literacy, which is essential. So let's assume, right, Penguin Random House, where certainly you work, biggest publisher, and they're doing amazing things. They've been cited a few times for their innovations and success in audiobooks. They're my publisher. So let's say that Tom Weldon, the chief exec there, and his leadership team go into their away day, and their bus blows up, right? And they're all wiped out.
Designated survivor.
Survivor. Who would it be? Derek.
Derek is the next most senior person. So by Dev Madison.
If Derek doesn't bring us in, it's war.
Gonna do. That's what he's going to do.
All right, so he's going to bring us in. Can I be COO?
So you're COO. Derek, say yes.
Okay. Yeah, why not? Yeah,
all right, cool. Great. Thank
Alex
you.
Is in. So now you're the leadership team of Penguin starting Monday morning.
Oh, my God.
Day one. What's the first thing you're going to do to change this industry up?
Wow.
Okay. Wow. Right. So we're going to take all those emails that are probably in their inboxes of people and agents who have books that, you know, need to be read and need to be published. What I will do is I will assemble a team who will look at all of those emails, and maybe the first thing I'll look at...
I love how Sam said, I'm the boss, but Ray's talking.
I mean, yeah, you
I think
can
Ray's
be...
going to get a promotion pretty soon. Or you're going to face mutiny.
Well, I'm a pirate, so of course I will. Yeah. And I will literally... I think I might go in there and search up all, like, ethnic names. People who have, like... People are not, like... I mean, maybe not a jack of the, you know, so maybe, I don't know, a different type of name, a different type of story. Okay. And I'll literally bring them in for a meeting, and every single one of them. Well, not everyone, maybe it's not feasible. But yeah. And then I will go through each, like, Waterstones bookshop, and I will be like, these are the types of people that I want you to put on their, like, the front of their bookshops in terms of, like, marketing and stuff. Okay. Yeah.
So you're putting a rocket under the diversity.
Absolutely.
Alex?
And I'll pay people more because you people are broke.
Alex, go ahead.
I think that I don't know what my role would be, but it's definitely something to do with outreach.
Okay.
So
oh, I love you.
I probably...
Christian Day's coming back.
Come to do missionary. No,
Let's reach out.
No, I probably...
We make a perfect penguin.
I'd probably...
Call it mostly Penguin.
I'd probably go to be in the schools, be with the influencers, be with all of these new people and new ideas. Get them in. Either get them in for a discussion, get them in for either interns or, you know, figuring out how we can market using these new ideas and these new energies and just making them a part. Even the book bloggers and the YouTube booktubers and stuff. I think that would probably be an interesting thing to do. I don't know. Like, I think that would probably just be... I'll probably just, you know, deploy the people out and just make it a huge wave across.
Yeah.
Make it a bit more of a...
Get the underdogs in.
What I would do...
What would you do as
quickly
CEO?
Quickly, before we go, I would literally... It's going to sound so wild. I would get rid of the classic back catalogue. I would absolutely obliterate it. and say, let's stop putting money into these. Yeah. Let's stop creating classics that are just very arbitrary most of the time.
Yeah.
And let's put more money behind upcoming authors who are going to take us to the next level.
We're going to put the classics in the dungeon so that they can be brought up by archaeologists when they want to like study people before us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're going to put them in the dungeon. Behind. We're not going to burn them because Jane Austen. No.
We don't burn books.
We don't burn Fahrenheit 451.
Okay. We have come to the end of the show. Yes. We actually run out of time. We have to.
Okay, he's just on the tweet.
Trust. If you need some new ideas around literacy for young people in schools, you need to get in touch with the guys at Mostly Lit. They've got new ideas for you. Clarissa Pabby.
Sam Conniff, ladies and gentlemen.
Sam Conniff.
Share that tweet.
Let's see if we can't get a response to these guys by Monday.
Thank you. Absolutely, a new imprint.
Yeah.
Or an imprint for black women. That's what I want.
Okay, so, we've come to the end of the show, guys.
I'm going to make sure that Derek is not CEO because I'm CEO. So.
That's her main priority.
Right. Oh my God, like have a recording that goes past our allotted time. I love it. Female Pirate. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Thank you so much to you, Sam, for coming on the show.
Sam, where can they find you?
Where can they find you quickly?
At Sam Conniff.
On Twitter?
Or bemorepirate.com. Where you can buy the books directly, or if you fancy someone who pays less taxes, go to amazon.com where the book is discounted now. Help me with my bestseller algorithm.
Thank you, guys. The book is out this Thursday.
Yeah.
Please go and buy it and tell us what you think. Tell Sam what you think. What else?
Don't forget to rate, review,
and subscribe, comment, and blah, 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 all that
comment,
stuff.
Send us your thoughts. Don't forget to email us at mostlylit@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And if you think it could be any better, start your own podcast now. From what I've seen, it's actually quite straightforward. It's a couple of microphones and some guys on a sofa.
He's trying to give us competition, but you know what? Yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. Right? Because we need pirates to make more pirates. Absolutely. Because we're pirates.
Right. Anyway, so this has been Mostly Pirate.
Catch us on the socials, rate, review, subscribe. See you next week, guys.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.